Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is a show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick up here on the podcast feed. And today I'm going to be reviewing a book from, let me quickly look up here, 1996, first published 1996. It's called The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell. And the reason I'm reading this book is quite simply, as I mentioned on the last podcast, I was like, okay, what shall I read? I wasn't quite sure what to read. So I went onto goodreads.com, and there's lots of different lists. And every time that somebody recommends a book to me that I've not reviewed or not read, I will add it to a bookshelf on Goodreads called Recommended by SFBRP Listeners. And so I looked on that, looked at the books that I'd not reviewed, and sorted them by star rating. And the top two books, one of them was the book that I reviewed last week, which I don't remember off the top of my head. Let me have a look here. Yeah, Peter V. Brett, The Warded Man, Demon Cycle, number one. And this time, and the other book, which was rated above 4 stars there on that same list, was, of course, The Sparrow by Mary Doria Russell. And I didn't know it at the time. This is actually this book is actually the first in this two books. There's a follow-up book, but I only discovered that there was a follow-up book after I had finished this book, because it turns out by chatting on Goodreads, people commenting on my review, they're saying, hey, you're going to read the next book. And apparently Mary Doria Russell didn't plan there to be a second book. But so many people asked, hey, what happens to this character? What happens to that character after this, that she wrote a follow-up book? And apparently it's good, but it's certainly not needed. So even though Goodreads calls this The Sparrow number one, this is just a very much a standalone book. It's not like the start of a series or anything like that. So I got into it and started listening to it as an audiobook. And let me just get straight into this. Also, people have said, this has been recommended to me many, many times. This book made a note here that it's one of the most recommended books. And previously, I've reviewed books which are kind of Catholic science fiction books, or books about science fiction, or about the Catholic Church, or Catholic characters living in a science fiction world. Of course, the most famous one is Canticle for Leibowitz. Which, weirdly, when it comes up, people think I hate that book. I don't hate that book. I might have ranted a bit about the last section of that book, but the first time I read it and reviewed it, back in episode number 41, I gave it 3 stars. And then the other year, back in episode 216, I reviewed it again and actually gave it more, a higher star rating of 3.5 stars. I really, really enjoy the first 2/3 of that book. It's just amazing. The last third is everything that I don't like about organized religion generally, and the Catholic Church in particular, just kind of being punched into my face, like forced into my face. And I'm just like, I hate this. I hate these characters. I hate this. And I don't understand how people can, I don't understand how those three stories fit together. Like the spirituality and the characters and everything in those first 2/3 is exactly what I like about, you know, about people going on a religious journey and questioning faith and questioning religion and, you know, experiencing spirituality and all those kind of things. And the last third is everything that I hate about it. So it's weird about it. So other Catholic science fiction stories that I've done, I think, what was the other one? Hyperion. There's a quite cool bit of there where I think it's Father Jury, who is a Catholic priest, goes to the planet of Hyperion and goes like on a mission to a very strange alien civilization / tribe type thing, and I really enjoyed that one. It's a different style of book. It's kind of like a horror book, but still fun first contact kind of alien stuff going on there. And what were the other books? I can't remember. Oh, Eiffelheim as well. I really enjoyed the more Catholic parts of Eiffelheim, the stuff that's set in medieval Germany. Really good fun there, medieval Germany. The stuff in the current day stuff in that book was just awful, and I just skipped that. I'd in the end really enjoyed like the Catholic-y parts of Eiffelheim and people like and Catholics going, ah, there is alien life elsewhere. What does that mean for humans? What does that mean for humans having a soul? What does it mean for God's plan for the earth if we're not special anymore? And I'm trying to think, there must be some other books that I've read and reviewed about that kind of thing, but I don't remember others that I've reviewed here on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. But it is just scrolling through the book list here, I can't really see anything, but it's interesting. I kind of enjoy the genre of religious people going on science fiction adventures and what that can bring out. Partly because I used to be a religious person myself. I was brought up in a Christian home. I lost my faith in my late teens, I guess, but it doesn't inform me. So it was actually quite interesting. When I started reading The Sparrow, I knew going into it that it was going to be about Catholics and things. And because I knew it might be about the Bible, I kind of like it was a part of the way through. And I was like, oh, I think I know what the name the Sparrow is referring to. Once I got into this, and I was like, okay, I do understand what it is. I actually thought it was a different person in the book, but who the Sparrow refers to. But let's get straight into this. Now, the setup for this book is pretty tricky, because it's really difficult for me to spoil this book, because pretty much the prologue says, hey, there was a Jesuit mission to this other planet, and everyone died there except this one man who was found in a kind of a brothel, and he killed someone and was having sex, and he became a prostitute in a brothel, and we found this guy. Oh, and this guy was a Catholic priest. So right there in the prologue, we get this set up, and you're like, okay, a mission to another planet, and someone and a Catholic priest ends up as a murderer and prostitute. I'm like, this is a good thing to start. You know, this is a good thing to start with. Yeah, it's that's it really. I don't know what else to say about the story. What happens? Let's break it down. There's actually kind of three sections to this novel. The first section is like in Earth in 2018, 2019, I think it is. Stuff happens in the Arecibo radio telescope in Puerto Rico. No, is it Puerto Rico? I should look it up. Actually, I think it mentions it here on the Goodreads page. So yeah, Puerto Rico, San Juan, and Arecibo in Puerto Rico, and we kind of get introduced to these different characters. There's Jimmy Quinn, who is an astronomer who works there at the observatory, and then there's a group of characters kind of centered around Emilio Sandoz, and he is this Catholic priest who is from Puerto Rico, and he travels around and he becomes a linguist going to different places, and then he settles back in San Juan, which is the place where he comes from, and kind of sets up a new mission there, and he invites some people, a couple who he knows from America, who he'd worked with in the past, called Anne Edwards and George Edwards. That couple comes in. They are not Catholics. They just say, oh no, we're not Catholics, we're just, you know, bleeding heart liberals, we just want to help out. And they kind of set up a new mission, which is kind of part clinic, part hospital, part, you know, part church outreach kind of thing. You know, all the good stuff of the Catholic Church is what they're doing there. And there's a few other characters who come in there as well. D.W. Yarbrough is another Catholic priest who Emilio Sandoz knows, and one of the main character, apart from, I think, Emilio, Jimmy, and Sophia are the three main characters. And Sophia Mendes is like a computer specialist, like an artificial intelligence kind of specialist, and her job is to come in, learn everything there is to know about somebody's job, and then replace them with a computer. And she has an agent, and her backstory is kind of interesting. I'll get into that more recently. Anyway, there's this whole group of people who come together, and Jimmy discovers the setup is that Sophia is brought in to replace Jimmy, and Jimmy's job is to work on the radio telescope, and if anything comes in with the SETI signals, any SETI signals or any things like that, search for extraterrestrial intelligence, anything that comes in, he's the one who reviews all the quirks in the signals and works it all out. And they're like, hey, we can get a computer to do your job, and Sophia is brought in to replace Jimmy. Meanwhile, he actually does discover a signal, and Sophia was like, my computer program would never have discovered that, so your job is safe. The signal comes in, it's like music, and it's music coming from Alpha Centauri. And this kicks off a big thing. And so what happens is that because Emilio Sandoz is there, and he's a Jesuit priest, and there's other Jesuit priests, and they're all about learning and science and discovering stuff as well. So what happens is that they put together the Catholic Church, or the Jesuit part of the branch of the Catholic Church, puts together a mission to Alpha Centauri using existing technology. And this is existing technology in 2019. I can't really see how they got to when this book was written in 1996 to 2019, how all this technology would come around, but whatever. When it comes to science fiction books and science fiction movies, I really hate it when people say, oh, this one part of the plot is unbelievable, therefore the entire book or movie falls apart. And And that came it came up when I was chatting about a recent movie, a movie from last year called Ex Machina. And they're like, oh, the security system doesn't make sense in that movie. Like, why does the security system work like that? And I'm like, hey, every science fiction book or story, I'll always give them a few gimmies. You know, there's those few gimmies. Like, I'll give you like two, maybe three big kind of science inaccuracies or factual inaccuracies and things. It's like the movie The Martian. They said, hey, the sandstorm on Mars wouldn't really be this strong, but we've got to kick the story off somehow. We all know this isn't really true, but let's just go with it anyway, just for the sake of setting up the story. And I'm always fine about people like taking some shortcuts with science or taking some shortcuts with, you know, reality to set up a good story. As long as it happens, as long as those rules are set up early enough in the story, like as long as it's in the first quarter of the story where you go, okay, so the world is different in these ways, and then I'm just going to let it go. You know, like in the Martian sandstorm, it's right at the beginning. You're like, okay, I know that isn't true, but I'm going to let it go because it happens early on. Where it really bugs me is where those things happen right at the very, very end of the movie, for example, or the books. For example, The Martian, where right at the end, you're like, oh, and everything we were talking about before, orbital mechanics, let's just ignore that because we want a better ending, a more action-y ending to the movie. And I'm just like, at that point, I'm like, no. Like, if those are the rules of gravity and if those are the rules of how the world works right at the beginning, I would have let it go. Anyway, at the beginning, we find out that the Jesuits are going to put this mission to Alpha Centauri together. And I'm like, well, how are they going to do this? Hand-wavy kind of stuff goes on, and they do put it together. And I'm like, it's a bit weird. It's a bit weird that you can just, you know, like some by spending an ungodly amount of money, or a very godly amount of money, the Jesuits like sell this property, sell these artworks, and manage to get together enough funds to put together existing technology to send a small amateur missionary and scientific mission off to Alpha Centauri. It does definitely stretch credibility quite a lot, but I'm like, okay, to really kick off the story, I'm gonna give you it. And even if that technology did exist, I'm like, well, why hasn't anybody else ever done this before to just go to Alpha Centauri just for the sake of it? It doesn't matter. This is kind of a ruinous cost for the Jesuits, but they wanted to do it anyway. And they do it. It's not so much that they do it in secrecy. They pretty much say, oh, it's not that we're doing it secretly. We're just doing it privately, secretly, making sure nobody ever finds out about this. And of course, the other big science fiction kind of gimme or scientifically uncredible way of doing this is where they go, oh, we just happen to turn up in a planet and it just so happens to be perfect for humans. The oxygen level is just right. The nitrogen level is just right. The CO2 levels are just right. The temperature is just right. We can eat the food and we don't all die, or at least not straight away. That's a gimme in most science fiction books where there's first contact and they go to another thing. Of course, it always is like, yeah, would it really be like that on the next planet over, on the next star over, going over to Alpha Centauri? But the thing is, I've read so many books where it turns out the closest intelligent life is Alpha Centauri, just because it's so handy to be able to get there quickly and get back quickly. So that's the second part of the book, is kind of like the first part of the book is kind of setting up stuff on Earth ready to go, which is a small part. And then the big chunk of the book is this mission, this scientific missionary mission on the surface of the planet, meeting the aliens, hanging out, learning everything there is to know about them. Fine, that's good. Now, the third part isn't actually afterwards. It is chronologically, if we're talking about the storytelling in the book, but it's interspersed all the way through. And this is how you can get away with, like these, you know, me just giving the spoilers up front, what actually happens. Because one of the characters, Emilio Sandoz, gets back to Earth again. Comes back to Earth, and there is now an inquiry. It's like, okay, tell us everything that really happened. We got lots of reports along the way, but there's a big gap at the end, and we want to know how everybody else died and how you survived and all that kind of stuff. And this is done very much as someone who has gone through some pretty bad stuff, as I mentioned before. All his friends have died. He's killed people or killed aliens, and it's classed as murder, and he's now a prostitute or whatever they think he is in this brothel. And so it's all read from that point of view. And because he's being, it's like an inquiry. It's not an inquisition. It's just an inquiry by the Jesuit order, like the main priests, what do they call them? The Father Superiors. And they're saying, okay, right, let's get to the bottom of this. So all the time is like at the start is like, well, I don't want to do much. But when they actually head off then to in the spaceship and get to Alpha Centauri, Rakat, as it's called by the locals there. This interplay really kicks off with this inquisition or this inquiry back on Earth in Rome, and then they go to Naples. And then that interplaying with the thing. So that's kind of the story and the structure, getting to the bottom of what actually happened. We're told right away what they think happened, and then we get the real story as told by the people there, by viewpoint characters on the other planet. And also we get this later reflections by Emilio Sandoz as he's back on Earth. So that's kind of the structure of it. And yeah, the main part of the book is, of course, this like anthropology on the surface of Rakat, because there's an anthropologist. Anne is an anthropologist, and they put these together. Oh yeah, okay. Here's another gimme. So, and this is actually commented on within the book as well. When you're doing a book about God and about spirituality, when I start these books, I'm always like, okay, does the person who is writing this book believe in God? Okay, that's one question. Second of all, if they believe in God or not, whatever, that doesn't always inform it. Within this book, do the characters believe in God? Okay, that's another question. And then the third big thing is sort of like, okay, within this book, is God actually real? And when they're actually talking about it, it's like, oh, we discovered this alien signal. Jimmy discovered this alien signal, and his friends, his best friends at the time, were Emilio Sandoz, kind of a good friend, and all these characters that I'd mentioned before, Emilio and Jimmy and Sophia and Anne and George and these other people that he knows. And it just so happens that the skills that all of them have is like one of them is an astrophysicist, one of them is a technician, one of them is an old U.S. Air Force or Navy pilot or something. Oh no, that's another character who comes in. But and this person is an anthropologist, and this person is a doctor, and this person is a linguist, and this person is a systems expert. All of them just coming together, and they even comment within the book and go, "Hey, isn't it kind of miraculous that this group of people who could go on this mission?" And I'm like, "Well, it is just a coincidence, but it's also just written that way. But it is one of those things that actually sets it off." When we get into these characters and we get into actually the story, like the characters themselves are going, this feels miraculous. And because this book is so much about spirituality and about faith, personal faith, and how it influences the lives of the people, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, the people believe God exists. Do they? Some of them do. Some of them are agnostics. Some of them are atheists, and they actually tease each other about the differences between there. There's lots of Catholics. There's people who are Jewish, kind of lapsed Jewish, as well. Anyway, that's another gimme that you've got to give. It's sort of like, oh, isn't it convenient? It's like, yes, but it's that convenience, and it happens early on in the story that it actually sets it off. Are these people the most suited to do this mission? Well, we find that out later on, of course. I think the structure is really nice. It's like the way that there's always the reflection of what's happening. What was happening in that main story thread of them actually leaving Earth and going there, always being reflected on and commented on. And there's lots of foreshadowing, and not even foreshadowing, there's lots of just saying, in the future, this is what's going to happen here. The way that his Emilio Sandoz is, there's something's happened to his hands, and that's a big thing as he goes through that. He has to work with these, with his hands don't work anymore. And that was such a big part of him, what he did with his hands, and now that's all just going. And he was a linguist and always had to work with his language, and now that's all he has, but some of it's being taken away from him, and there's lots of stuff going on there. So yeah, it's the way that these parts reflect off each other, I do think it's kind of like it's like the best example of non-chronological, or it's one of the great example of non-chronological storytelling. I'll get onto that more in a bit when I get onto the characters. So the world is actually, there's not really much to say about that. There's some fun, the 2019 near future, near-ish future stuff is okay. I mean, there's some stuff about Istanbul becoming a war zone, and some stuff about, some politics here and there, and Japan has taken over the space race. Not really much going on there, because again, it is very much about this small group of characters. And I do like the way that some of those characters are portrayed within this world and what they've done in their lives, but it's not really a big focus. Even less so when we get into the far future, when we get to, actually it says here on goodreads.com, there's this great thing, setting. Borgo Santo Spirito in Rome in 2059, and then Naples in 2060. You know, so a long way out into the future in Roman Napoli. That is described in even less details, because pretty much it's all just like inquiries. Like, we are in this room, we are talking to this one person. We don't go outside because the press is outside, and that is it. The end. You know, it's not really described at all. We just understand that this mission has had a big impact on the Jesuits and on the Catholic Church, more generally. So the world of Rakat, the alien world that they go to, is suitably explained. I mean, it doesn't go into a lot of detail about the world itself. You know, we go a bit description. Oh, there's this thing here and this thing there. Like, but it's much more of a kind of mystery going into this. This part isn't spoiled up front, so I don't want to give too much away. But it seems like a very, I don't know, kind of a tamed continent, a tamed world, that it's kind of been in balance for a very long time. That's what it felt like going in. Plot points later show that that is actually the case. But it feels very tamed, like everything is ordered and everything is sorted out this way. There seems to be different layers of history going through there as well. But that's a big part of the book, which is actually really interesting. This book is very much about anthropology both ways. Anne is a anthropologist in a book, and she's like, right, I've now got to talk to these people. And there's very interesting linguistic stuff going on there as well. Two of the characters are linguists, or put it this way, Emilio Sandor is our main priest character. He is a linguist, but there's other people who do linguistic kind of things too. And it's a lot about science and anthropology, and that's pretty good. As I then looked here on the Goodreads page, it says about Maria Doria Russell. She holds a PhD in paleoanthropology and is from the University of Michigan, and also just studied cultural anthropology at the University of Illinois, and social anthropology here. And you know, and she love she Russell lives in Cleveland, Ohio, with her husband Don and their two dogs. And I was like, oh, right, okay. I thought this kind of in the book that Anne was Mary, but now I'm realizing, oh yes, Mary Doria Russell is Anne in the book, or Anne is Mary Doria Russell. And I guess Don is like George, but the husbands are the same. But they don't really. George is in the book, but he's always like a side character, like an ancillary character to Anne in the book, and which is quite fun. So, what else do I have to say about the place? Yes. Oh yeah. So the book is very much like this anthropological stuff, and I would have lots more to say about that, but that's kind of the meat of the book, which you discover as you go through and plays into the plot and plays into what's going on a lot more. So I don't really want to get too much into that. So coming on to the characters more specifically, everyone is like, it does get to that bit where everyone is kind of a bit too perfect in a way, but this is a book about a mission, like a religious mission, and the question comes up literally that, oh, this character is so great, he may even be a saint in the future, because there is this miraculous thing. Emilio Sandoz, there's this miraculous thing that was happening. He was there when the first signal came, and he organized, kind of inspired the first mission, the first Catholic mission to this other planet. You know, he's the first person to step on the other planet. It's like, hey, this guy, and they've been saying at the time, this guy's amazing. He should, like, even though he's still alive, like, we should really consider sainting him, like, or canonizing him. This guy's going to be great, which of course it brings up very much more tragic when you actually realize what happened to him later on in the story. But that's the whole point of this book, is that it's about people who are selected for being really good at what they did, and being like, either by God or by happenstance or circumstance, and then additionally being selected for by the Jesuits of being like the upstanding characters and great characters. And so it does feel a bit like, hey, we're the good guys, we're the good gang here, we're all nice and we're innocent and everything's like that. But that is actually what the book is about. It's about these people, and especially with like the atheistic characters, it's like, are these people, and the different religions, it's like, can these people suitably represent humanity to another species and to another planet, even if they aren't Catholic? Even if, I guess that's a similar thing that goes on in the movie Contact as well. I guess the book Contact, but I didn't finish that. So where it's sort of like they go, you know, you don't represent humanity because, you know, 5 out of 6 people on Earth believe in some kind of God and you're an atheist, so you can't represent us. We'll go with a Christian guy. And then it's like, okay, atheists, we'll get, it'll be fine for an atheist or an agnostic to represent humanity. And you kind of get that same thing going on there. So this book is about goodness without religion, goodness without God, goodness without spirituality. And it's interesting to read about that. You know, again, it does seem a bit weird. Like, oh, everyone's just so amazing and so perfect. It's like, yeah, that's what the book's about. Like, we're literally sainting some of these characters in the future, maybe. Now, the really clever bit about this book, that the foreshadowing and the kind of giving away the ending at the start really works well with, is that we are told everybody dies. And then, after being told that everybody dies, except this one guy, we then get to meet the people who we know that they're going to die, and then we spend a lot of time throughout this book with these people, these kind of good people and really likable people, knowing that they're all going to die before the end, and you're just waiting. It's like, are they going to die now? No. Are they going to die now? No. And we get hints of the way through, and I'm like, no, when did this person? I don't know when this person's going to die. And because we like all these people, it's really good. It's difficult. It's like really hard going. And it brings an insight into their characters. It brings their stories around in a way that it shows, I don't know, this weird, not futility, like they're all working towards something. For example, there's this kind of love triangle going on there. And for various reasons, put it this way, if I was reading this not knowing that those characters were going to die and not knowing what was going to happen to these characters at the end, especially Emilio and what happens to him at the end and these other characters, I'm like, okay, this would be kind of tiring. Like, this love triangle wouldn't work. It's not suitable. But as it goes through, this love triangle is telling you, I know it was telling me so much more. It's not just a love triangle. Oh, we need some sexiness here. We need some love. We need some romance. No, it's actually about like what it's like for a priest to be celibate and then be involved in the love triangle. Like, and will he give it up? Will he give up his celibacy? Will he lose his virginity to someone? Would that actually be suitable? And then again, somebody falling in love, actually a few different characters falling in love with Emilio and what that would be like as well. And then Jimmy, the kind of the third leg in this, sort of like what happens to him. And then later on in the book, as it starts resolving itself, I'm like, oh, this is really great. And it would be a bit like it, like for the characters, it's like, oh, this is really great. And it would be a bit like, oh, isn't this nice for all the characters that it's all working out? But I know I'm in the last hour and a half of the audiobook, and I'm like, but this is all this good stuff's happening, and I know they're all going to die soon. So as you go through that, it's just really great storytelling. And again, I'm not giving anything away story-wise. I'm just saying this is the way that this book affected me. It kind of reminded me of Firefly. I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, that when I watched Firefly, I didn't know it was a TV series. I just saw a trailer for the movie Serenity. And it was like Serenity, science fiction-y kind of adventure. And I'm like, great, I love science fiction-y adventure stories. Why not? And I watched it, and suddenly all the characters knew each other right away, and I didn't know the characters. And it was like about halfway through the movie, I was like, oh, okay, this is actually, this must have been a pre-existing movie or series that I don't know about, because they're like, oh, well, this guy can't wait to meet this character. Anyway, just to say, in the movie Serenity, which wrapped up the TV show, I think there was like 15 episodes or 14 episodes and then the movie, not all the characters make it all the way through to the end of the movie. A few of them die, or let me say one or more characters die in that movie. So, right, okay, that's fine. And then I went back and started watching the whole series all the way through, and I was spending time with these characters, and I knew what their ultimate fates were. I was like, okay, those two people, I know they're going to get together later on. But that was unintentionally spoiled for me. So as I was kind of being like, I want to get to know these characters better, but then there's kind of that distance. It's like, oh, well, that character, I know that character dies, so I don't want to get too attached to them because I know they don't make it in the end. And it's only really good storytelling where this works with, and I think Firefly is fun storytelling because it's so much about this cast of characters that you get into and you're like, yay, this person, and you're like, oh, but that person doesn't make it in the end. And of course, my girlfriend at the time, Pola, long-term listeners of this podcast will remember Pola. I don't think she was ever on an episode, but she was always hanging about in the background. And so, and she, when we started watching, she didn't know those characters were going to die. And as we were discussing that, as we were watching the series and talking about it and seeing this and seeing that, she didn't know how it was all going to end. And when she got it, it's sort of like one of those lessons in spoilers that she got a totally different emotional reaction out of these characters dying than I did. But again, it's those kind of like watching something for the first time, watching something the second time was what I loved about this book, is that I kind of became more attached to these characters knowing that they're all going to die in the end than I would have without it anyway. So, actually, I think I've talked about individual characters quite a bit. Emilio, Jimmy, Sophia, are just looking at the on Goodreads. I didn't realize there was this section on Goodreads right at the top. It's like characters, setting, literary awards, other editions, you know, so I can just look at the names of the characters. Yeah, they put together this mission. I liked D.W. Yarborough. There was like these two other guys, and I'm like, are they the red shirts? Are they cannon fodder? No, actually, one of them plays a much bigger part in the story, kind of introduced later, but was a bigger character, which was quite good fun. What I really liked, though, was the characters who were all minor characters in Rome and Venice, in part of that inquiry, the people talking to Emilio about his experiences and getting him past it, and they bring in some doctors, and they bring in like different people, like the higher ups in the church who come in, and I like people like Vincenzo and John Candotti and Johannes Vocler and those other characters there. It's really handy just to have the names listed here on Goodreads. I should use this feature more often in the future. So yeah, I really enjoyed them because they were kind of a cast of characters brought together. Like the Jesuits seem to be kind of, they always have their head screwed on in some way that they really care about this kind of stuff. They're like, oh no, we're going to do this right. We're going to do by the system, and we're going to bring it in here. Like this person knew you then, so we're going to bring them in. And it kind of felt like a kind of very controlled situation there that they were trying to get this story out of it. Now, once we actually get to the other place, there's a few alien characters that we meet. There's this whole group of aliens, and they're all like the same kind of thing. And I was like, wow, these characters aren't very intelligent or very interesting. And actually, that's part of the story. It's like, oh, no, these are kind of herbivore kind of characters over here. And they are going to be a bit dim, a bit like slightly more more intelligent cows and sheep rather than like more intelligent monkeys. And there is another character who represents like the other faction of aliens there as well, a guy called Supari. Now, I really liked him. And what I really liked him is, again, we were told right up front what his motivation is. He comes in, he's introduced into the story, and he is like, we know what his motivation is. He talks a lot in his head about what his motivation is. And it's not a human motivation, it's an alien motivation. But then straight away, we're brought back into like the characters, like the main characters, the human characters' point of view. And it's really difficult for them. They don't, even though they kind of know what that motivation is, it's not a big thing for them. So all the time, it was amazing that I was reading it. And because we were spending so much time in the heads, or along with the viewpoint characters, the human viewpoint characters, I always knew, like, intellectually what Supari's motivation was. But all the time, I was empathizing so much with the human characters that I was always like, oh right, this is a this is like I don't know, it's like I kept on reading him as a human, and right at the start we're told this guy's not human. He doesn't care about what humans care about. This whole other thing that's going on here, he's not doing it for humans' sake or for science's sake or any concerns that humans have. He has this one motivation, and that's what's going to stick with him, and that's what does stick with him. Anyway, again, I don't want to give away too much about the anthropology of the differences between the aliens and the difference between the aliens and the humans, because again, that's the big chunk of the book that isn't spoiled, so I don't want to talk about it too much. But I really did enjoy it. There was a few like these things that were sprinkled in. I was like, oh, I see where this is going, and I was right in some ways. And there was another time I was like, oh, I see where this, and it was the opposite. And I was like, oh, okay, very well done, well done. That's the thing I've talked about spoilers before, and like using my own intelligence and being impressed with myself as I go through the book. I always want to be able to see, and like in advance, about 80% of what happens. And if it works like that, then I'm really happy, because I feel good about my own intelligence and intuition and storytelling, kind of knowing about storytelling and all that kind of thing. So about 80% of the time. But then the 20% of the time, I want to be surprised, and I want to be made not to feel stupid. But if I don't see something coming, if I don't see 80% of the story coming, I think, well, that's either bad storytelling that random stuff happens, or I just feel too stupid, you know. So I always like a few bits and pieces to catch me out in a book, but also I like to be able to see all of the misdirections as misdirections and actually see them, you know, and see where the story is going and things like that. So to put numbers on how I like to read. Anyway, yes, bring on. Oh, the writing of the story is pretty good. The descriptions are okay. Really, this comes down to, as I said before, about the characters. And what I really liked about the characters is I did like most of the characters. Some of them were a bit more vague, but generally everyone was good fun to get on with and are well-rounded characters. And there was lots of things to find out about all these different characters because, you know, they had secrets from each other, and they would find out the secrets about each other. And even if we knew some of the secrets, that was good. And again, some of the secrets about their pasts and their past sex lives and stuff, we knew about in advance, and when other characters found out about it, you were like with them on their side. And other times it was sprung on you, and I quite liked about that. But what I really liked about this is that the characters got on well and had fun together. And the fun that they were having together was actually funny. The stuff that was happening was delightful. Not always laugh out loud funny, but there were a few times when I was really laughing. And I always hate it in books where someone tells an okay joke, a bit of wordplay, and I don't find it that funny, or it's only very, very, very mildly amusing. And then we're told by the author, all the characters fell around laughing at that joke. I think Brandon Sanderson is a big one for that, because he only has one type of joke and everyone finds that joke hilarious. Of course, he finds it hilarious because that's his one kind of joke that he can tell. But here there's these really fun situations that they get into, and there's lots of playing off against, you know, sort of like, oh, well, you're a religious person, and, you know, you're a priest, so why are you like this, and why do you have this opinion, and why are you like that? You know, a lot of the humour comes out of the complexity of people's interaction with faith and religiously informed, or, you know, priestly informed activity, and how that interacts with their real life. And and it was genuinely funny. And when the characters are actually genuinely finding it funny, I am also genuinely finding it funny. Like, one of the things that it even talks about is like, yes, and they went into space, and the first conversation that they had in the morning was about how difficult it was to have sex in zero G, and the frustrations of being celibate when people are having sex in the cabin next door to you and things like that, and enforced celibacy by other accounts as well. So yeah, I actually really enjoyed that writing. The audiobook is good. Here we take a break, and I'm going to do the, well, not a break, it's still part of the review, but I'm going to do the audible.com plug here. I listen to this book via Audible. You go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and you can listen to this book. It's 15 hours long, and it's really, really good. So if you've still, after listening to almost 300 episodes of the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, if you've still not, signed up and done an Audible trial, now is your time, because this is a really good book, and it's got a really good narrator. His name is David Colacci, I guess, and he does lots of characters very well. He seems to do, like, the aliens are interesting, but not in the and the different accents, you know, he brings out for the different characters are really good. He's got some good... actually, there isn't one. This is the only note I made as I was reading through this. I just looked here on my phone. The Sparrow, two lines. Worst Australian accent ever. And that was my first note. My second note was, then later, his accent was all Australian. Because, again, one of the characters puts on an Australian accent. They're not Australian, but they puts on an Australian accent, and the author is like, yes, and it was an amazing, perfect Australian accent, but the narrator did one of the worst Australian accents ever, and I'm just like, nope, his accent was not all Australian. So, you know, a very minor complaint, because I think there's only like three sentences with Australian accent, but it is the only thing that I made. Anyway, otherwise, apart from that, really good narration, a good gap between different sections, really good it was made very clear where we were in each one of those books just by kind of the tone that he set with his voice, and the writing went together really well. So if you're interested in listening to this book, As an audiobook, or reading this book by listening to it as an audiobook, check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP. You can get this book for free if you sign up for a trial. You don't have to continue the trial, but if you do, you get one book per month or two books per month, depending on what you do, and you help support the Science Fiction Book Review podcast in that too. So that's the audiobook plug out the way. Let's get on to what's the final section here, themes. Don't actually have any notes here, but there, because there's just so much, and I think I've talked quite a lot about it before, like the whole like the abstinence stuff, the sex and abstinence is plays such a massive part into the story, because we know going into it that Emilio Sandoz was a prostitute at the end. He was there in a brothel, and you're like, but so much of this book and so much of his character is about him being a priest and him, you know, like struggling with his abstinence. And you're like, well, how is this going to play out in the end? Don't want to give too much away, but it's incredible how much of the book it feels like it's sort of like, oh, and they're, and even as I said, oh, they're just joking about having sex in space. No, all of that plays back in to like the major themes of this. And also the first contact stuff is kind of first contact both ways. Like, of course, it's first contact between humans and aliens, but then also it's back the other way as well. It's sort of like the aliens are having to kind of have contact with the humans, and often, well, it doesn't always feel that way, because so many times when there's like, oh, it's first contact and some scientists go off and try and discover here, whereas this isn't that. You know, this is not a group of scientists. It's a group of, I mean, some of them are scientists and they're publishing scientists that back for the with the Jesuit, you know, papers. They want them to be published when they broadcast them back, but that's not what it's about. You know, when they turn up, it's not like, oh, okay, we have to follow these rules and this is what we're going to do with first contact here and there and here and there. It's just like, okay, we are here. We are being humans in this area. And us being humans, even though we're on another planet, is the most important thing. Us being a human mission, a Catholic human mission, is just as important as doing the science. So it feels like it was much more human group on a different planet than a group of scientists on a different planet. And that seemed to be very intentional, even to the point where I was like, wow, this is really bad science. It's like, oh, yeah, but they're not just here for science. Oh, this is really bad, you know, this is really bad biology. What are they doing? This isn't healthy. And then, you know, and then people die and you're like, oh, and then someone died. It's like, yeah, of course, but they're not scientists. They're human. It's like a human mission, not a science mission, which I found interesting. And then there's a whole big section, all of this kind of stuff about, you know, about personal sacrifice and faith and losing faith and how bad stuff happens to good people. Was it theodicy? Like, why do bad, if God is good and God is perfect and God is all powerful, and God is all-knowing, like, how do bad things happen in the world? And that's what a massive part of this is. Certainly the last section is. But you kind of know what that's going to be about, and so everything that comes before builds up to that really well. And I really enjoy that kind of stuff. You know, what is it like to give your life over to something greater, and like the sacrifices that entails? And I really love that about this book. And that's actually coming back to, you know, A Canticle for Leibowitz. That's what I really love about those first two parts. It's always about the balance of like, okay, like, what do we sacrifice? What do we preserve? What do we give up to have this connection with God? And I really like that, you know, that discussion in those first two parts of Canticle for Leibowitz. It's like, right, there's this person who wants to be a scientist, and they have these keys from the past, you know, from the past pre-apocalypse technology, but what do they want to do? Is their faith and is the church and what they do, their life as a priest, as a librarian, as someone, as a, what do you call them? There's a script, you know, the scriptorium people, you know, what is more important to them, their life and piousness and the life of the church or progress? And that's what that's what I really like about the first part, that it's playful going backwards and forwards. Like, he finds a blueprint and then he discovers, like, oh, blueprints are only blue because it's actually the white that's printed on the blue, and I've been taking bits of white paper and colouring in all the blue and leaving the white left over. And then he discovers that's incorrect, and there's that whole thing, well, actually, I won't tell anyone this because everything that happens before. And they're like, okay, this is fun. This is a fun exploration of what people, like, even though now he knows what's doing wrong, like, his kind of, like, what he gets out of that isn't being correct scientifically or historically. What he gets out of that is the kind of the spiritual fulfillment and religious fulfillment of doing that activity over and over again. It didn't actually matter what it was. It didn't actually matter what the piece of paper, what the blueprint was. It's like how it reflects on his life, these priests' life, and what they go through and what they give up to continue their life. And that's a really interesting thing. Part three of Canticle of Believer, it throws all that apart, and it's about, you know, being people being like priests punching other people because they, you know, don't believe they should volunteer for euthanasia. And it's like all of that other stuff. Whereas this book keeps it all the way through. Like, what is spirituality? What has to be given up to keep believing in God? What has to be given up to keep serving God? I find that really interesting. And this book is like an interesting way of looking at that as well, which I find very interesting. So, I think that's all I have to say about it. Really good book. And people seem to be a bit, I got some comments about this on my review, and someone say, oh, I'm not really sure, how is it going to do it? You know, I hope you don't rip into this because this is one of my favorite books. No, I don't think I've had anything bad to say. It's not a perfect book, but it is one of those books where I just enjoyed all of it, except for two instances of bad Australian accents. It was just an amazing listen, a really interesting listen. The pacing always felt good because, again, I knew what was going to happen to one character in one situation at the end, and everything was building towards that. And that's very rare that I'm like giving away the ending of the book has been so effective. In this, it really did work. Putting aside the scientific inaccuracies and the, you know, there's a few gimmies at the start where I'm like, really? Really? Are you going to do this? But I can't mark the book down for that, because that's what the story is. It's like, really? Just next door, there's a planet which is perfectly breathable atmosphere and food that doesn't kill you. Really? Is that really what we're going for? But, you know, that's just something you've got to give away in some of these science fiction books, and this one in particular. In every science fiction book, there's always going to be a few things where you're like, really? Is that really it? And that, so in this case, it didn't dampen my enthusiasm or enjoyment of the book again. So, unsurprisingly, giving this one, if you've listened this far, 5 stars, because there's just nothing bad about it. Again, it's not a book for everyone, but it was the book for me. This is the book about Catholics in space, Catholic priests in space, which I didn't know I knew. And I didn't realize I wanted to read so much. Of course, so many other people realize I wanted to read this because it's been recommended so many times. But for me, it was really good. I can put aside other readings and put aside my own atheism to enjoy a book of this quality, with these characters, with this message, even though I've not given away too much of what the message is. There's lots more I could say about this, but this is one of those books where I think I've expressed what I like about it. Other people could probably find other things that they enjoy in this book just as much as me. So that's it from me. You can email me, luke@juggler.net, and so I do reply to every email that I get, especially if you ask me a question, I'll get onto that. The best thing to do there is actually go over to goodreads.com, become my friend, and join in with the discussion on this book. I think the most of the discussion is not going on in the SFBRP listener group on Goodreads. It's going on my review, because I posted a review and it's had quite a few comments on there as well. So check out what other people think about this book. I only have a saved version of Goodreads page, so I can't see what other people say about this book. I only have the top section. Not sure why. I thought it saved the whole page, but it actually only saved the top section of the page, not anybody else's reviews and stuff. Anyway, 4.17 stars after 20 years, this book really does hold up well. Mostly. There's some science stuff that you're like, really? In 2019, this is what it's going to be? Look, science fiction isn't about predicting the future. It's not always about getting the science right. It's about going on an interesting story with what you have at the time, and that's what this book did. So, literary awards. Arthur C. Clarke Award for Best Novel won in 1998. Best Foreign Novel in 2001, the Kurd Lastovitz Prize. And also what I saw on the Wikipedia page, which I don't have now, people were saying, oh, it's not really science fiction. It's like, yeah, okay, this is a book that's like 1984 and like these other books, which people then say, it's not science fiction just because it's a really good book. So I totally understand this. Yeah, you got the John W. Campbell Memorial Award for a nominee, and the James Tiptree Jr. Award as well. So, and the Pudley Award for Science Fiction, don't know what that is. Never heard of the Pudley Award. But yeah, good book. Next up, actually, I don't know what book I'm going to read next. I was looking through because I ran out of Audible credits, and I was looking through what other audiobooks that I have left over here on my computer. And there's this one interesting torrent which is called the 100 top science fiction books audiobooks, and someone found a list of the top 100 science fiction books. And found the audiobooks of all of them. They're mostly bad quality copies of books on tape, literally tape recorders play back into a computer. But so I was looking through there, and after this, I was like, oh, it's a bit Ursula K. Le Guinish because it's sort of like anthropology on another world. And I saw here I have on my computer The Lathe of Heaven, so Ursula K. Le Guin. So I'll probably get onto The Lathe of Heaven at some point. Because it's an Ursula K. Le Guin book that I've not read, or at least I don't remember I've read it before. I've not reviewed it, and it sounds good. So I'll get on with that one soon. Yep, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter, and episode 300 is coming up. Don't know what I'm going to do, if I'm going to do anything special about that, but if you've got any suggestions, send them in. I already had a question. Hey, are you doing anything interesting for episode 300? No idea. But if anyone's got any ideas, I'll do something good, or we'll do something good if I'm back at home and Juliana's around. Otherwise, it'll just be a normal episode, I guess. 300 isn't a big number, I guess. But it's a round number. We'll see how it goes. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.